Well, welcome to The Window, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Moss, the author of Barbecue, the History of an American Institution.
And I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
Today, we're feeling gloomy. We're going to do the doom and gloom edition of The Window and try not to keep it too depressing. But we do have some doom and gloom topics that we want to talk about. One of them is about restaurant reviews, or specifically the fate of restaurant reviews, the future of them. And then we want to get into, I think, restaurants a little more broadly as well. So I'll start off. Hannah, I wanted to talk, really just more ask your opinion on this, because
sure.
I was speaking to a food writer friend of mine over the weekend, and she mentioned something that I just really hadn't noticed, because I guess you wouldn't notice. It's like noticing something that's suddenly not, that's slowly not there. But it's the more and more local newspapers are not doing restaurant reviews anymore,
right.
Formal restaurant reviews. And, you know, I knew that there were very few people whose full-time job was restaurant reviewers, but I really hadn't noticed that just at the sort of the large daily papers in cities across the South and across the country, there aren't restaurant reviews anymore. And when she mentioned that, I said, really? Well, that's interesting. She works for a paper that's owned by one of the big chains that owns all the papers all over, and said that, yeah, that restaurant reviews just don't drive the clicks, online clicks specifically, is what she was saying, that other types of articles do, which I thought was took
yeah,
me by
I've
surprise.
Never heard that. That's unusual.
Well, that
maybe
her,
maybe
her,
that's true
that's
for
what
her
she
market.
Found in her market and their paper,
okay.
is that other types of food stories would drive a lot more traffic to the website. And therefore they were shifting to focus more on that.
And is that true for papers throughout her chain or just her market?
I think throughout the chain, but
wow.
I haven't gone and checked, but that's why I thought I'd ask you. And I know you're part of like the Association of Food Journalists and mm-hmm. various other organizations. So have you been hearing similar things from the market?
No. I mean, what I've heard, obviously, it's too expensive to do reviews.
Yes.
So that's why most papers have done away with them. I imagine there are probably also some smaller papers that are worried about the blowback that is just an inherent part of reviewing. Mm-hmm. And if you can't stand to lose a single advertiser, you're probably not brave enough to be in the reviewing business. So, yeah, as things are economically unstable.
And she did mention the cost of it, which is to say that the two or three visits cost so much, but then it doesn't drive the metric that they want to get from the corporate side.
Right.
And so therefore those types of stories get pushed away.
And now again, I'm not familiar with her market or her metrics. Ours tend to do pretty well. I mean, they're better read than anything else the food section puts out. I have no idea, because we don't really deal with them, whether they're able to sell ads around it. So I don't know if that's something that they're dealing with. A review is not appealing to advertisers.
Yeah.
There's a potential there, I suppose.
That's interesting. So one of the things that she mentioned as well was that what does get traffic are not the reviews, but the first looks in
her
market.
Oh, those do great.
Yeah. But she really wants to do them only if she's going to be the first one there. Like if other people have already beat her to the punch.
No, that's not first look.
It's not first look, right?
Second look.
So it's not just like the first one that the daily, because they're competing now with eyeballs for all sorts of online publications.
Sure.
I
mean, and that's my rule on anything is I tell every publicist, every restaurant, you can give an exclusive to any outlet you want, but just so you know, I won't repeat it. So if you ever want to appear in our paper, you got to tell me first.
Oh, I didn't know that. Give me the exclusive.
I don't demand that. It be exclusive. In fact, I say, you know, if you want to give it to everyone at the same time, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, because you're fast.
Right, yeah, exactly.
you're sitting there by the computer.
Because I know I'll be first. But if you choose to give it to another outlet, I will never write about it.
Yep.
So just keep in the back of your mind. Reviews are expensive. And I think one way that papers got around that, smaller papers, not the major big city dailies, but smaller papers would get around it. And actually, you're an example of this. People who could self-fund a little bit or didn't need to make a full-time job out of being a critic would pick up assignments, right? Like how you did it freelance for a city paper. The problem was, in many cases, those were people, as I said, who were self-funding, or they tended to be richer people. And we now are no longer interested in what, you know, rich white men have to say the way we were a few years ago, apparently. So, yeah, I think that's a harder model to sustain.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. With, you know, it's you can't make money doing it as a writer more, you know, from a freelance basis at all. Because the publication has to pay for your meal. So you get a free meal out of it.
But, if we're talking about freelancers, maybe those who actually do need the money, you're not going to make any friends doing it. Yeah. You know, it's really risky to go out there and say, well, this is a terrible restaurant, because for all you know, 6 weeks later, you're going to get a pickup assignment from the local magazine where you need to approach this restaurant. So if you don't have the backing of a full-time job and a paper that supports you, it's really hard to pull off.
Yeah, truly, speaking as a freelancer, that exactly was the case. I mean, I had to stop doing them because as soon as you want to write anything else and you want to go interview chefs or you want to go to festivals or anything like that, then you get to know people and all of a sudden you're not anonymous anymore.
It's impossible.
Yeah, it becomes a different thing. You can still write about restaurants, but you can't do the sort of review beat, the regular review anymore.
But I respect what your friend said, but I haven't seen evidence of that. I don't know that it's true in other big cities. I don't know if she was able to point to any places, but it seems to me that people are still enjoying reviews as much as anything else.
Well, she did say that she thinks Charleston's a special market. She's not in a tourist city, right? Uh-huh. So we have a huge tourist market. People come to Charleston just to eat. You know, mm-hmm. there are culinary tourists. I'm not sure if that's changing a little bit, but it used to be the case, at least, that, you know, you'd have people whose primary reason for booking a trip here as opposed to somewhere else was because all the restaurants we had.
Yeah, but do you think that's who's reading the reviews?
I don't know.
I would say if you were a tourist, you're more likely to read your hometown critic when he or she made a trip to Charleston, or you're going to read a name you know, which is Eater. That's what I do, honestly. Like, if I'm going to a city where I don't have a food writer friend and they don't have a critic and they do have an Eater, I'll look at the Eater 38.
I absolutely do.
It's a great place to start.
I think it's almost – there's usually the two places I'll go will be Eater if they have a – you know, even Eater has some dedicated – cities like Eater Charleston.
Yep.
But even if they don't, they'll do Louisville or somewhere. They'll do articles about the other – the top – restaurants in various cities.
Yeah.
And they're very reliable. I mean, they're not going to pick the – it's not like going to Yelp and getting the top 10 reviews on Yelp.
Right. No, so they have the advantage of having national recognition, a national name, but local people on the ground. So it's really kind of an ideal combination. So I think it's really hard for newspapers to beat that. I think the folks who are reading the reviews I write are people who read them on a weekly basis. They feel like they have a relationship with me, a relationship with the paper, a relationship with the city. I'm sure tourists sometimes come across what I do, but I don't think that's a real big part of it.
Yeah. And maybe it's more just there's more interest in food in Charleston than it is in other cities.
That's
definitely
huge.
A foodie city.
No question.
I was going to say the other things besides the Eaters, I find that like most cities of a decent size have their own local magazine. Mm-hmm. Like we have a Charleston magazine that's usually, whatever you name the city, it's the name of the magazine. They tend to do some pretty good roundups as well. So I tend to go to whatever city I'm in and go find that Baltimore magazine or whatever it is and look at their top 10.
Because I think, I can't speak obviously for every restaurant critic, but many newspaper critics, I think like me, are interested in how the city is developing. Yep. It's inside baseball stuff that a tourist doesn't care about, whereas a magazine is going to take that sort of glossier approach. I mean, I just was looking at one now from Washingtonia and like their list of 100, and that's not what our list would look like, but it's really useful if you just want a great meal, which isn't always what a critic at the local paper is curious
about. Yeah, and that's the thing, if you're a critic at the local paper, I did it for a long time. You still do it. You're doing a beat, so you got to cover the new places that open, and you got to go revisit places that have had significant changes. So you're trying to provide coverage of all the dining options. You're not just cherry picking the top 10 or the top 20.
Right.
It's hard. You'd have to read all and collate a whole lot of reviews if you were from outside town just to sort of figure out where to go.
For sure. And because I think, because we are speaking to our audience, it is important if in Charleston, if a restaurant opens serving Thai food, that might be something really important to the Charleston audience. Doesn't matter so much if you're coming from New York, So I think that's the both the, the advantage and the problem with the local criticism.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I do miss, and of course Jonathan Gold passed away a month or two ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. He was sort of the pioneer of what I consider of a genre of restaurant criticism that wasn't all about the fine dining and the flashy places and giving five stars to everything. What I sort of miss, I think, in those roundups and things is a sense of criticism or in the term critical or a context, providing a grounding right. for restaurants and putting it in a scene and that, you know, getting the feel of a city that you could get like reading. You can go for back sure. and read Jonathan Gold's collected reviews, like Counterculture, mm-hmm. I believe it's called.
Counterintelligence.
Counterintelligence. Mm-hmm. It's a collection of his reviews, and you yeah. can read them still today, and they're great.
Right. And you can read it as a travelogue to yeah. LA, which is what he intended. Yeah. This is a way to help both Los Angelinos and those who aren't get to know their city. So
I'm afraid we'll lose that as well, as you lose, you know, if you're losing the dedicated beat critic who, you know, someone who understands the city and right. understands the scene and how it's changed and why certain things are important or not important compared to, I think we talked a while back about trying to review something without the context mm-hmm. outside the four walls of the restaurant. I don't think it can be done. So.
Yeah, but again, I have not heard of any like outbreak of restaurant critic firings or anything like that. I think we're sort of where we were a few years ago. So, I mean, it's expensive, but I don't think this time to.
Well, now I'm going to look into it a little bit more. I'll come back to the report, but hopefully the restaurant critic is not doomed. From the critical voice as opposed to the top 10 list or the light quick bite kind mm-hmm. of approach to things, or first look where you're going to a restaurant on the opening day or before opening day before they've shaken out right. the kinks and all that kind of stuff. So that's the review of the restaurant. But one thing that is definitely doomed in some sense are many restaurants. There are a lot
restaurants in Charleston.
In Charleston specifically.
King Street
specifically.
Yeah. Right.
We know that because they are closing down.
At a crazy rate. Yep.
And I know that's something that you've been digging into a whole lot lately.
Yes.
And I have a big piece in the works on
that.
Well,
I figured it out.
Okay.
I figured out what happened. So
who is killing the great King Street restaurants in Charleston?
So let me say two things, because this is obviously a topic that comes up all the time. I mean, this topic has come up since the day I moved to Charleston, which is it a bubble? You know,
yeah.
and I have always said no. It is true.
I can say I remember when restaurants were moving block by block up King Street.
Right.
We were all saying, "How can we support this?
How can this happen?" And I always predicted a fairly stable future for Charleston restaurants, because it seemed to me that once a city, and we've talked about this, has a reputation as a place to go eat good food, it sort of remains that way. Yep. Now, of course, I assume there would be some fallout, and that doesn't mean that every restaurant is secure, but that overall things would be pretty stable. And then this year, things have gone wild. So we have hit the moment of volatility.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, restaurants have been closing, and the restaurants that have closed in some ways have been the restaurants you wouldn't expect. 492 closed.
492 I wrote my piece of paper here. That was the first one that came to mind as one that really surprised me when I heard they were closing.
Exactly.
Down.
So we can talk about restaurants that closed, such as Bar Normandy, Sparrow. Both of those restaurants, which were really beloved, you would think maybe on paper, you would think that they would continue to thrive because they had loyal customer bases yep. and they had tremendous talent. So you think if you're going to make a restaurant work, talent's all you need. But at least in the case of Bar Normandy, you also need a hood. So
yeah.
that place, like...
that was related to the Bar Normandy had to close down because of infrastructure within the building
right.
and they couldn't afford to put it in.
So what unifies that with the Sparrow closing, not just were these, you know, high quality food beloved within the F&B community, they were both examples of chefs trying to save money on overhead.
Yeah.
In the case of Sparrow, they hadn't really hired any employees. And if you don't spend money, you end up spending time.
And the location they're in was very bare bones, just
right.
sort of like the secondhand tables and things. So they really didn't hire an architect to spend a lot of money overhauling a building like so many restaurateurs do.
They didn't spend any money.
And it was all about the food.
Same thing at Bar Normandy. Yeah. Alex just kind of moved into the bakery.
Yeah.
He didn't decorate. They put up a menu board. You know, so they saved a lot of money. They spent a lot of time. And in the case of Sparrow, as was the case at Two Burrows Larder, which preceded their mm-hmm. closure by a few years, so it's a little bit off the radar, but they got exhausted. They got worn out. So that's what happens. If you don't spend the money, you spend the time, and then you close. So I'm setting those two closures aside. But so if talent isn't going to see you through, you would think money would do the trick.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those.
So 492,
for instance, was
backed by Anita Zucker, mm-hmm. who is a very, very wealthy woman. And this is not news.
Yeah, maybe like in billions.
Billionaire.
Not millions, but
right,
billions.
Right,
yes.
right, right. Now, I imagine I'm not familiar with her. I'm not seeing the restaurant's balance sheets. No. I don't know. So, I mean, I think this is the case. If you're backed by one person with a lot of money, you probably are subject to various whims, and one person may decide, I don't want to do this anymore. But I think it really came as a shock because it seemed like pockets don't get deeper.
Right.
And the restaurant was certainly designed to look that way as well. So that, I think, as you said, was really that was sort of a wake up call of a closing. And then we got other ones that are closing and other ones that are about to close. I, in all my years covering the Charleston restaurant scene, I have never heard people more anxious about what's closing next. It's
So what else has closed up there that is public?
So it's closed.
Because sometimes you'll see restaurants are up for sale or auction.
Right.
You know, so you know the owner is looking to get out, but they don't necessarily close. You know, that's not a
– Right,
just
right, right.
Just someone wants to sell, it doesn't mean they're going to close.
So I guess the only other significant closure to discuss, and this was kind of the framework for my story, was the end of the Getaway and the creation in its place by the same owners of Bootleg Tavern. And so this is sort of the story that I think is starting to play out kind of everywhere. And here's what it comes down to. So if you remember back a few years before I was here, when you were here covering the Charleston restaurant scene, it started getting a lot of attention.
Yep.
Okay. Well, if you just take your mind back to it all of a sudden.
I remember. Yes. It was an exciting time.
It was an exciting time.
It was a great time to be writing about food in Charleston.
Great time. Yeah. Great time for everybody. So what happened was, is we start getting chefs working throughout town, chefs, sous chefs, cooks, feeling pretty good. Like they're working in a pretty exciting place. They're learning a lot. They're getting better at what they do. They're having opportunities to travel to festivals. Some of the great chefs in the world are coming here for festivals. So the level of culinary ability and achievement just continues to go up and up and up and up. So you have even the sous chef in a restaurant that might be like 14th on your list of favorite places can do things that the top chef in a smaller town, you know, would never imagine being able to do. Okay, so you got this group of talented folks in the kitchen. Then you have all the people who are reading this coverage of all the good work that they do, and they're reading it at their homes and in Miami Beach and New York City, and they look at the paper, they turn on the TV, and they say, my goodness, Charleston looks like a great place to open a restaurant. I think you could make a lot of money if you went to Charleston and opened a restaurant.
Yeah, I do definitely remember that period where a lot of New York restaurateurs were talking about how impossible it is to run a restaurant in New York and how long it takes and how much it costs to open one. And they start looking south and say, I'm going to go to Charleston. Or some went to New Orleans and thinking, it's going to be much easier there. I can make it in Charleston a lot easier than in Manhattan.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you end up with now is a restaurant owned by someone with no restaurant experience and a chef who has a tremendous amount of restaurant experience, and in fact, is feeling pretty good about him or herself.
I guess that's another dynamic, which is that restaurants, not just as Charleston, but restaurants in general became very cool and hot in a way that they weren't 20 years ago.
Hey, I got a restaurant. Come by. I'm an investor in this place. You know, we can get a seat. It's, you know, don't worry about a reservation. Come on. I'm a partner in the – okay. So it became very cool.
Because it was cool to have your own restaurant.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it wasn't just about how much money you could make. It was, as you say, the cachet of calling yourself a restaurant owner. All right. So it has always been true in the restaurant business that there's the person who owns the restaurant who's making sure that the thing doesn't go under, you know, and they make some money, and the chef who has big ideas about buying organic food and buying, you know, an oyster that was carefully, you know, seeded 6 months ago and tended every day with lullaby, you know, and and they've always been at odds. This is nothing new. Yeah. What's new is how far apart these folks are now. So now you have the artiste on one side, the businessman on the other, and they don't even come close to meeting. So it used to be you would have restaurant owners who had restaurant experience. You would have chefs who had kind of come up through places that they needed to, you know, help keep afloat, you know, and they were thinking about numbers and money. Now there's none of it. You've got creativity here, money there.
And
a disaster in between. And that's what's playing out all over town. It's somewhat simplified, but that's basically the dynamic. And it couldn't have happened any more clearly than at the Getaway, which was they hired as their executive chef Emily Hahn, who'd previously worked at Fig, was the executive chef at Warehouse, and was a former star of the show Top Chef.
Yep.
So talk about a chef that, like, has her chops and knows it.
Yep.
The owners, two guys from Somerville, who will not return my call, so I'm just speaking. I got to speak for them because they wouldn't want to decide not to speak for themselves here. The businesses they had previously were a home health care business, and they opened a crash course school for dental assistants.
Okay. So not exactly restaurants.
Yeah, exactly. And that.
I mean, dental, you're sort of close.
Right, you're kind of in the same general area. But that's it. Hmm. And they went in and they could never find common ground. And it turned into about 10 months of bitter fighting. And there are sidebars to the story I want to add too. But so where, you know, Emily would say, hey, people are really enjoying the Cuban cuisine. And they would say, let's get Bud Light on draft. And it's like, all they wanted, and I hear this from folks, oh, I'm sorry. Another restaurant that closed was Pancito and Lefty.
Yes.
Because in many ways, there were some similarities in its story. It's
Pancito
really,
and Lefty was a short, well, long.
Longer than Getaway.
Lived in opening.
Right,
they were constructing and announcing for years,
yep.
Like 2 years, I think. And then it closed, a year or so after opening? It wasn't open for very long, at least in the—
Pancito and Lefty.
Yeah.
It closed in the last month.
Yeah, but it wasn't open for all that,
long. No. It opened, I think it's over a year.
Over a year. But I think it was in development longer than it was open.
Right. So what it comes down to, the more I talk, and I talk to dozens of people for this story, what it comes down to is these business guys, they don't have a lot of patience. They want to make money fast. And they look up and down King Street and they see kids, some of whom aren't even legal age, but they are not going to ask. They see kids lining up for Bud Light on draft and they are bound and determined to be the ones to sell it to them. It used to be. I talked to John Keener, the president of the Charleston Restaurant Association, and he said, well, you know, you just have to, you know, figure out your conversation with the chef. This comes with time. These new owners aren't giving anything time. Mm. And it is right around the year mark for even the most patient restaurants where the owners say, I think it's time we just sell shrimp and grits. And they've come in with a concept that's a lot more interesting. And if you get to the year mark, comes the wings, the draft beer, and the shrimp and grits.
It's really sort of amazing. I was looking just for the record. I went back and looked. February 2017 is when Pancito and Lefty opened.
Oh, so a good bit more. So a year and a half.
A good year and a half.
Yeah. Yep.
But nevertheless, the one surprising thing is that somebody who's a business person. Mm-hmm. Would want to go into a restaurant. And it's everyone knows that the restaurant industry, have been saying it for years, it's a very hard place to make a buck. It's a low margin business.
That's what they hear. But what they see are the people. And if you've tried to walk down King Street on Friday night, you'd think,
you look like there's money walking
around.
There's
money just walking. It's just here for me to take it. So there's that gulf. It has resulted in a situation that even absent the closing is so volatile. I was trying to come up with a good way to measure it. And I don't know that this is perfect, but I think it gives some idea of the situation we're in. So we spoke about Eater earlier. Mm-hmm. Every Eater bureau, I don't know if they call themselves bureaus, but you know, every city office establishment tracks what they call chef shuffles.
Yes, right? I look at
chef
that frequently.
Chef in, chef out. Yep. Well, you look at it more frequently than your friends in Denver or Boston or Austin, because as of my writing, which was last week, I haven't checked since, and I think it was remained so. We had 12 chef shuffles. Okay, 12. So that's more than one a month.
Yep.
By contrast, every other eater, if you average them together, had 2.
Really?
Yes.
So this is not something that This is not a national problem. It's a real estate problem.
It is exactly. Yeah. It is exacerbated by national problems. It is exacerbated by the rising cost of rent. It is exacerbated by short staff.
It's more pronounced here than in
comparable
cities.
But what's happening here is weirdly unique. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So let's talk back up a little bit to talk about the shrimp and gritsification of these kind of restaurants. What drives that literally? Is it more like the chef and the vision isn't working and the business people finally say, well, this is what actually sells and turns us a profit? Or is it more that the business people are saying, this is what I want my restaurant to sell?
No, they just want to make money.
They don't really care. They would sell foie gras and
they'll sell whatever
know.
It takes to make money. And again, that's what's kind of complicating this conversation between the two parties. They have no common ground. It's not like, well, I like shrimp, you like oyster. Yeah. You know, it isn't that kind of conversation. These folks, some of them, I don't think they even eat. You know, yeah. I mean, they're only in it for the money. So that's the problem, is they're just finding no way to move forward with these discussions. They're in different worlds. And Emily would talk about that she would go to meetings and bring up things that were relevant to running a restaurant. And you know, and the owners would say, well, if only we put more surfboards on the wall. And it's really frustrating.
So I guess that's where I'm going. You know, is it the case that Charleston, perhaps the diners here aren't as sophisticated and forward looking as either they once were or we thought everyone was?
Well, I mean,
they say they like this, but they really want Bud Light and shrimp and grits.
Sure. Yeah. I, you know, look, the restaurant that replaced the Getaway has only been open now for a few weeks. So I don't think we know.
And that's the same owners, right?
Same owners. They just
new concept.
New concept. The new concept is you can go in and get a pound of fries. That's their new concept.
It's a concept that has been proven successful.
You
for
can
years.
Also get just about everything else. If you look at their menu, it looks like it came off, kind of like printed off a generic website. Like, here's all the things you can get: pasta primavera and probably shrimp and grits. So is that new menu going to bring in new people?
Yeah.
That's what we don't know. I don't think it's fair to say that the problem is the Charleston Diner, because it hasn't yet been proven that just serving bad beer and bad food is really a successful strategy. It's a desperation strategy, and it's just now being tested.
Yeah. Okay.
So another element of this, which is really interesting, which I wasn't even able to get to in my piece, is that this comes back to women are getting hurt by this more than men. So I didn't delve into this in detail in the piece, but you know, we talked about, I think earlier on the show, that we started the year with 12 female executive chefs.
Yeah, previous episode we talked about that, and you know, conflicts with owners and a lot of departures of those female chefs. So we started off with
how many? Either 11 or 12. Oh. I don't have the notes in front of me. Let's say 11 to be safe. And now we have three.
Three.
Right. We have three. All three of which, this is the important part, all three of whom were well established in their executive chef jobs when the year began. So again, they're fine.
Yeah.
But in terms of the volatility, it seems, and this is just a theory, this is not proven, that in the wake of the Me Too movement, it became one more amenity for your restaurant. Like, let's hire a female chef. And boy, these restaurants that just kind of came in and tried to do everything they could really quick, they didn't last. And so a lot of these restaurants that were flailing around were associated with women, and now the women are out. There's also, once you talk about business versus creativity and trying to have the conversation between the two, women don't fare as well, not because they're any less talented at conducting business, but because, as we know from study after study after study, they're not particularly well respected by men in the realm of business. And that struck me as really interesting, that this isn't just a matter of, like, I think there was so much talk when all these sexual harassment revelations were coming to light about, oh, you know, it's so hard for female chefs because, like, a locker room in there. What's really hard is it's like a boardroom in there.
Yeah. I was gonna say that the locker room stuff has changed a lot.
That has changed
over time.
But what hasn't changed is women aren't getting the kind of respect they need. And if you are trying to negotiate, which is what restaurateuring has come down to, it's really hard.
Well, it just sounds like I can just hear the mansplaining of, you know, of a business person telling the chef, well, you just don't understand food.
That's exactly right.
Let me tell you how it's
that's
supposed
exactly
to run.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Mm. So there is this kind of sort of gender dynamic at work as well that I think probably deserves some attention.
Well, it does make it seem like, in a healthy restaurant, there is going to be that tension between the business side and the culinary or creative side.
Always.
Any business that involves that is going to have that, particularly restaurants, though.
Right.
But it seems like then the power imbalance is such
as little as these restaurant owners, investors, and partners know about restaurants, that's about as much as chefs know about business.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so, they never sign contracts all through Charleston. I mean, and it's funny how many chefs I spoke to who are bound by now by a non-disclosure agreement, which means the restaurant owners know about contracts, but they're not.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't even think about that that side of things.
Yep.
The NDAs don't surprise me. They're just a rampant problem in business today.
Yep.
But most chefs are working without contracts. I didn't
realize that this too is kind of dates back to like Charleston being just a good old boy place. Things are worked out over drinks almost always. They're done via text.
Actually does not surprise me at all.
It doesn't surprise me when you think about it, right? But it really, when you talk about just the uneven place that these chefs and owners are at, that the chefs don't ask for contracts. When they do ask for them, again, there's almost no negotiation. Many, many of these chefs don't know what they're worth. And the question is, how much are they worth? Because if you're going to just sell beer, you don't need a chef. So there is limited leverage. So, yeah. I told you I had a lot to say about this.
Yeah, and now I'm just trying. You got me on feeling a little depressed.
You promised us a doom and gloom show.
It's so definitely doom and gloom. Because I'm trying to figure out how do you get around that. I do recall during the heyday, the glory years, a few years back, after I'd sort of gotten out of reviewing and was in that position to hang out with a bunch of chefs finally, in various events I was at with chefs, they were often talking about the nuts and bolts of business. Mm-hmm. They're talking about food costs and they're talking about those types of like the inside baseball talk.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if that's and these are chefs who are mid-career and been around Charleston for quite a while.
Yep.
I'm wondering if that's something that has not bubbled down after becoming a chef became so cool.
That's
and hot,
exactly right. That's exactly right. And so, they don't teach in culinary school. Well, it's not that everyone goes to culinary school, but those that do don't learn it at all. I mean, I talked to Dean Sabo, who's here, the dean at our local Culinary Institute of Charleston. And he said, if we cover anything relating to business, it's about how to fire someone within the law.
So it's an HR law.
It's an HR law. Just don't get in trouble.
That's
it's not about
me.
Protect yourself.
And just seeing lately more and more grants and programs trying to send people to culinary school and all this kind of stuff. And part of me says, well, please don't take out a student loan to go to culinary school.
Of course.
You can go get a job in a restaurant and get paid to learn all that on the job. I'm not sure how possible it is these days, but compared to the way it used to be. But you shouldn't have to go be taught in a school when you could learn something on a job. But one thing that would totally make sense to teach in a college would be the business.
That does make sense to go to school. And again, they do teach things besides just like how to dice vegetables. There are things that they teach that I think are valuable. But business would be a great one because there is no sense. And I think, as you say, it used to be that the creative and money sides were a little bit closer. And the two partnerships that everybody in town points to as, boy, they do it right, are Mike and Adam at Fig in the Ordinary and Brooks and Tim, who have a Little Jack's, Leon's, and Melfi's. Yep. In both cases, both partners have restaurant experience. Both of them are like really close. They talk to one another. So even though like Mike is the chef and Adam isn't, they still like are in the same, they have the same vision. And most importantly, all four of those guys are around their places. Yep. And that's what I'm hearing about some of these new restaurant owners is like they never show up. So that's another opportunity for learning lost. Just as we talk about chefs not learning in school, these guys who are buying restaurants.
See, and that's something that I think we've talked about in the past as well, is the decline of the restaurateur as opposed to the chef.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, the person who owns the restaurant is the face of the restaurant, around the dining room. I mean, that's for years and years and years, that's what a restaurateur was. They weren't back in the back cooking, though they knew the menu very well and probably could go back and cook.
Yep.
But they had cooks or chefs, but they were the face of the business out front. But when your owners are investors who are looking at this as a, why would you invest in a restaurant thinking it's like, go put your money in like a stock market or something. You'll be much, much better off. So, looking forward, I know there's probably some off the record and some things you heard. Mm-hmm. Sounds like these couple that we mentioned, Pantito and Lefty, The Getaway, 492, these are not going to be the last.
I don't think so. I don't think they're the last. I think this is for real. So we'll see what happens.
Now, I've always, you know, with the restaurant industry, you always know when one's restaurant's open, especially when I was back reviewing them, I'd go review and say, this place isn't going to last a year. You can sort of tell.
Right.
You know, like, because it's a numbers game. A certain percentage of them aren't going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing this only with newer restaurants, or do we feel that same tension happening in restaurants that are a little bit more established and been around for a while?
Yeah, it's a great
longer?
Question. One of the questions I started asking people I was interviewing is, what's going to close next? Yeah. And I always heard about restaurants that had no more than 2 years in the city. I'm not ruling out that an established place would close, but this does seem to be something fairly unique to the latest wave in restaurants. That's all for this edition of The Window. We recorded today's episode in the gloomy podcasting studios at the Post and Courier building in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Window, help other listeners find us too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you access your podcasts and like us or leave a rating. The Window is a production of the Post and Courier and Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was the doomed?
I hope he's not doomed.
J. Emery Parker. Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
And as a reminder, if you haven't yet, go check out the Post and Courier's Facebook group. It's Post and Courier Food. Okay, until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
And I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.